Well, good morning. It is Henry Harris. It is Thursday, November 21st, 10 a.m., and it is time once again for another installment of the weekly Emunah Teleforum. This week's topic is going to be looking at madrigas and mindsets, levels of consciousness, and moods. That's another way of saying it, madrigas and moods. So we'll be distinguishing between those two and looking at kind of the common denominator about those two notions. And beginning, we're going to just simply give us context for what this call is about. This call is an exploration of a simple truth, the truth of there being a single simple source behind all existence, that being the case that there is simply no other creator, no other cause, no other power that can change or affect anything other than the divine. And that includes even our psychological experience. And that's really kind of the emphasis in what to me is novel about this conversation, is the idea that the divine energy behind all life is also behind our psychological experience. Let's look at that as we typically do. Let's consider that the events and circumstances of our lives can look to be the actual causes of our experience. And certainly it's normal, and we'll be speaking about that this morning. It's certainly normal that people can be affected by the circumstances around them. But in truth, if we scratch the surface, we'll see that even the same person is not experiencing a kind of static, consistent emotional experience in the presence of what are otherwise identical circumstances, right? We have moods. We have different internal experiences, even though our circumstances might be consistent and similar, our experience of those moods are not. We are on the receiving end of a divine live feed, a live feed of divine energy that is showing up in our heart. We pointed this in the context of the Torah gives us a metaphor for that by virtue of the notion of the heart. The physical heart is right this moment, as you're listening to this recording or this call, the physical heart is pumping blood throughout your entire system. Every one of the 50 trillion cells in your body is reliant on what the heart is delivering in the form of oxygen, in the form of nutrients. Now, what's interesting is that you're not doing anything. You're not cognizant of it. You're not managing it. You have really zero involvement on a conscious, active level in the moment-to-moment operation of the flow of your heart. But it's happening, and not only is it happening, it's highly consequential. You are unquestionably experiencing the effect of that flow. It's affecting your life. It's literally keeping you alive, even though you're doing nothing to maintain it. And then simultaneously, the heart is really made up of two kind of parts. It's got four ventricles, but four... Yeah, I guess the ventricles, chambers, I'm not sure the biological term, but there's four parts that really make up two parts. One responsible for the directing of newly oxygenated blood coming out of the lungs to all over the body. And then in the opposite direction, when every one of those cells receives the benefit of the oxygen and the nutrients, in the usage of those things, the cells create poison. They create CO2, which literally would cause a person to die if they didn't have a means of exit. So in the opposite direction, your heart is pumping that toxin out of your system, but it's flowing. It's flowing through your system, and there too, you're not managing that, right? So what do we see? We see that there is this highly, highly life-giving, life-consequential flowing through you. And in the same way, the Torah says, there's a spiritual heart. You have a spiritual heart. It's actually made up of two parts. That's what the Talmud says. The Talmud says that your heart, in spiritual terms, is really two parts, just like the physical heart. One which flows with what's called the Yetzer HaTov, the inclination toward understanding and insight and divine aspirations. There's a certain kind of peaceful understanding and broadened consciousness. that is coming directly through you from beyond you. In the same way that your physical heart is not something that you manage, your spiritual heart is not something you do not cause the flow of that peaceful, broader consciousness through your system. You feel the effect of it, but you don't cause it. You're not the author of it. You do not have the power to generate that. No matter how many times you listen to an inspirational idea, no matter how many times you teach an inspirational idea, there's nothing that you and I can do that has direct capacity to change an internal experience or anything for that matter, right? We are not creators. We are not the causers. We're going to talk about how we are given power and how crucial our power is. But the beginning of understanding our power is the understanding what we are not the power behind, right? So the flow of this consciousness is flowing through us, and we are not its cause, but we experience its effect. And the ability to see the truth behind, like, that divine energy is what animates our moods. Our the Yetzer HaTov is what allows us, it's a flow of consciousness that allows us to see a certain broader perspective, and then simultaneously the spiritual heart flows with what we would call Yetzer Hara. Yetzer Hara is another way of saying the perception of the world being a darker place, a place of mistrust, a place of shame, a place of accusation, various kind of an insecure energy. There's various ways to point to it, but I think we know what we're talking about here. And your heart flows with that consciousness as well, and it's completely you're not the author of that flow. It's not personal to you that you have such a flow flowing through you. You experience its effects, but it's not you that's making it. It's from the divine. And the challenge and opportunity is to acknowledge and see the truth that the experience of life that I'm having, the psychological felt experience of my life, is coming from the divine energy behind life. And the heart is a beautiful metaphor to see how that works in my consciousness. And the opportunity to tell the truth about that is the mitzvah of Emunah. The mitzvah of Emunah is the commandment to acknowledge that there is a single creator, a single power behind all life. That is the mitzvah of Emunah. And the parallel kind of flip side of that mitzvah is to acknowledge that there are no other powers than that single, simple power. That the mitzvah of not to ascribe power to things other than God is the commandment, the prohibition of idolatry, right? So I have that kind of twin opportunity in a given moment where I encounter a darker feeling, or alternatively a warmer feeling. In any case, either way, the opportunity and the mitzvah is to be clear, what's the truth about this psychological experience? I could have a warm and uplifted feeling, and I could say, oh, I feel warm and uplifted because I just got a nice review from my boss, or I just made a sale, or I just got a really nice report about my kid's performance in school. Now, all of those things are it's normal. Like I said, it's normal that human beings associate those phenomena with warm feelings. However, we can know that the truth remains that my psychological experience is not coming from the event itself. We know that the truth, the simple truth, is that it's not coming from there. And when I acknowledge that truth, that is Emunah. That is Emunah. That's the mitzvah of Emunah. And that is the mitzvah, alternatively, of lo yelucha, of not to ascribe powers to things other than God. And it's an extraordinary accomplishment. And what I want to reiterate, that this understanding and the pursuit of this understanding is itself a mitzvah. It doesn't. I certainly want to be clear that I'm not suggesting that this is a means of controlling our emotional state or a means of fixing our emotional state. It is a pursuit of truth for the sake of truth. It happens to be that the truth tends to simplify our life because we are by nature aligned with the truth. There's a very deep and simple part of us that is aligned with the truth right now, and our conscious mind can kind of obscure that. And we can kind of lean into the thoughts and the feelings in a way that can obscure that simple truth. But our nature is aligned with that simple truth. So that's my intro. And as I shared at the outset, the conversation I want to focus in on right now is the distinction between moods and madrigas, the idea of kind of temporary ups and downs that that human beings are subject to on an ongoing basis, and then simultaneously the idea of a madriga. Madriga in Hebrew means literally a level. And a level represents something more than a mood. It represents the idea of kind of standing at a state of awareness that's more of a, it's kind of part of something that someone can be in possession of, you know, that it's durable. A madriga represents a level of understanding that has a durability to it. And I want to highlight a scenario that was described to me and see if we can illustrate. There's a simple truth. The same simple truth is underlying both moods and madrigas, but there's something that has become more clear to me recently that I'd like to share about recognizing that there are places in our life where we are, you know, experiencing moods, and alternatively where we're not, where we're experiencing a madriga, okay? So I got a call from a yeshiva guy, lovely guy, who is in a small base midrash where there's just not a lot of guys, and the experience of the presence of every guy kind of is more noticeable, and there's a couple of guys who have a habit of they have some kind of a pleasure and habit in putting each other down, and this boy is, you know, he feels the lack of refinement of it, and it feels really unpleasant to him. Like, he dislikes it greatly, and he's kind of challenged because he toggles back and forth between resentment of these boys he can't avoid them. Like, they're around, and their conversation and their style of conversation is kind of sometimes affects him. You know, sometimes it's just the surroundings. So there are times where he feels this kind of a burden and resentment toward them for what he thinks is just, you know, inappropriate. And then there are times where he's like, you know, so much so that there are times where he contemplates, is it necessary for me to consider leaving this yeshiva? But then he's kind of like, yeah, but that doesn't make sense. Like, there's a part of him that realizes that seems extreme. Like, he basically likes the yeshiva, and he basically recognizes that these guys are good guys. They just have a bad habit. So he kind of takes the onus upon himself, but it doesn't feel good because he doesn't know how to get out of it. So he feels stuck. He feels frustrated, and he's not sure what to do. He doesn't like the feelings that he's feeling, but he doesn't sense that it's appropriate to leave the circumstance, and he doesn't know how to alleviate his feelings. So I heard that's the scenario. So when I heard him, I said to him, well, look, I would just like you to consider that the behavior of these boys is not the actual cause of your emotional upset or your resentment, whatever those unpleasant negative feelings are. They themselves, that behavior itself is not the actual cause. It's true, if they weren't there, they weren't doing what they were doing, you wouldn't experience the effect of that emotion, right? You wouldn't feel resentful in the same way because whatever, it wouldn't be there. It certainly seems to be in some way a contributor. But but at the end of the day, you know, we can look and we can see, even in, this is where I'm going with this, is that this would be called a nisayon. This would be called a test. A test is a kind of an experience of distress or difficulty that's a combination of a person's level of consciousness in the presence of certain circumstances. If these circumstances weren't there, he wouldn't be walking around with this annoyance, resentment. On the other hand, it's important to understand that it's not literally the case that the circumstances of these boys' behavior is absolutely the cause, because it is possible to envision, well, two things. First of all, if he looks closely, he'll realize that his bother level in the presence of their behavior is not the same. There are times where it's more acute, he really feels the burden and the resentment. There are times where it's softer. Even in the context of that nisayon, where he's aware of this being unpleasant to him, even there, if he looks more closely, and this is true for everybody in every kind of struggle that we experience, whether it be depression, whether it be an addictive behavior, whether it be prolonged conflict, it's never the case that it's literally static without a change. There are ups and downs, even in the state of the kind of prolonged difficulty. So if he looks carefully, he'll see that, and that should give him a clue that it's not so simple that it's a one-to-one ratio, their behavior and his feelings, right? There's already room for, like, something else is going on here. There's some other variable than just their behavior. And that should, you know, that points to this truth. That points to this simple truth that there is an internal world that is being shaped. We're living not just in a world of, you know, traffic and physical weather and et cetera. We're living in an internal world. The Almighty is there's a divine live feed inside our hearts that is animating our inner world. It's a world in which he is animating our internal experience of a greater feeling of kind of peace and calm, or alternatively a greater experience of agitation and vulnerability or insecurity. There is already a fluctuating nature to that. Now, so that's step one. Step two is that anybody who looks in their life will realize that there are circumstances that at one point felt difficult, really difficult, and at some time later stopped to be a source of a similar distress, right? Like, there is such a thing as I'll give an example. There's a thank God I have wonderful children, and one of them has a habit of there's a greater level of upset and kind of demands that this child has, and it tends to weigh on the siblings, and it just kind of tends to up the level of tension and conflict in the home, this child's kind of demands and needs. And I can definitely see that, like, I noticed it the other night that I saw this child had done something. He tends to kind of comment and criticize his siblings when they leave things out and don't put things away. And suffice it to say, the siblings don't like hearing that from him. And then, lo and behold, I noticed that, once again, this same sibling, who's so kind of, you know, bothered, regularly leaves his possessions out, regularly leaves his cereal bowl, his books, his other things just out in the kind of common area, and doesn't do anything about it, and yet is very regularly kind of bothered and complaining about what others do. So it's funny, because I noticed as I saw it, I got an initial hit of, like, you know, of upset feeling toward the child. But then it kind of quickly softened, and I realized, yes, what this child is doing is inappropriate. There's a certain kind of double standard. There's a certain kind of control and manipulation, and, you know, it's just not nice, especially given the fact that the child himself is not holding, you know, by that standard. But I realized immediately, like, I see that the feeling of love I have toward the child has moved. There's a lot of warmth that I feel toward this child, a lot of just a deeper feeling of compassion and desire for this child to have a lovely life and a good life and to have be happy. And I just am in touch with the specialness of this child, and I love him. And so what happened is that I made a note to myself, like, it's not right what he's doing, and I'm going to confront him, but I totally could feel the difference about the feeling of confrontation that would be present in me. You know, like, I could see that I would be looking out for his good with love. As I just, there was a different feeling of navigation that I could offer this child. And so that's what I did. You know, I found a time to talk to him, and there was a real feeling of love. I was firm. I was adamant that this is not right. But I was, But I felt love toward the child. And what occurred to me is that that's really what a nisayon is. A nisayon is where the circumstances of our life feel burdensome based on our present our current level of consciousness. We have a level of consciousness in the sense of like, you know, I feel more burdened about X in my life, and I'm not sure how to overcome it. But I can know the truth. I can know the truth that is the essence of a nisayon. The essence of a nisayon, of a test, is that the Almighty exposes me to a place in my life where I haven't seen fully the truth of God's oneness. I haven't seen fully the nature of the truth about how everything is being directed and there's no other power than divine energy. I haven't seen it yet. So that's what happened with regard to my experience of my child, is that my child was always lovable. It's true that he was doing things that were inappropriate, but there was always a deeply loved and beloved quality to this child. And I just was kind of, based on my level of consciousness, I was more burdened by his behaviors. And my aperture, the breadth of my perspective, the level of consciousness that I was living in was just, you know, there was a measure of insecurity, there was a measure of narrowness that I was more aware of the burden than the beautiful, beloved quality of the child. And then something shifted. But the key to approaching a nisayon, the key to approaching a test, is to acknowledge that the truth is the truth, even though I can't grasp the feeling behind it. You know, the truth is expansive and broad, right? And we learned in last week's portion that Avram was commanded by God to take his son Isaac and bring him up as an offering. And then in the end, when he was ready to do it, God said, don't do it. So Rashi brings the Midrash that says that Avram was really like, he was just completely dumbfounded. And he turned to God and he said, look, I just don't get it. First you tell me I'm going to have a son after all these years, and that son is going to be the continuation of my lineage. Then you tell me that I should bring the son as an offering. Then you tell me, don't bring the son as an offering, it's okay. And so I was like, I don't get it. Like, I don't see, I have no cat, I don't, you're truthful, you're one, you don't change. I don't get how this is consistent with you. Now notice what Avram said was, I don't see it, but I acknowledge the possibility of there being the oneness, that your oneness, your unchanging oneness. It's hidden from my view, but I'm loyal to the phenomenon that there's an unchanging oneness to you. And then God said, now I'm going to show you. Now I'm going to show you. I only said bring him up. I never said slaughter him. And now you understand that I was never deviating from my original commitment. You didn't see it at the time because your perspective was your perspective. And the nature of a test is that we have an opportunity to be loyal to the truth. This boy is experiencing the suffering of these other boys' behavior, not because the behavior is inherently a source of resentment or annoyance. It's because the circumstance plus his level of consciousness produces a feeling of distress. But if he is loyal to the truth that says, look, I know how the world works. I know the nature of how all there is the divine. And I can only see based on the level of consciousness that Hashem allows me to see right now. And I'm committed to being loyal to his truth, even though it just feels such like a, it feels so like an assault on my experience, but I'm going to be loyal anyway. And at some point, God is going to open the door for us, right? In the same way that at a certain point we left Egypt. We were in the place of Egypt. It was constricted. It was painful. We couldn't see. But we held on to the truth, said, okay, this is Egypt. Egypt is painful because God is allowing Egypt to be painful. But at a certain point, insofar as God is the reason why Egypt is painful, it can stop to be a place of enslavement and constriction. And lo and behold, it was. That is the plan. That's the metaphor. That's, this whole world is a world of Helam. It's a world of hiddenness. Because we were placed in this world to seek the divine, to seek the truth of the divine, in a world in which by nature there is the possibility of God's oneness being hidden. And so what we have, and we feel that hiddenness, it's burdensome upon us, but there's where we get to be loyal, that in the presence of that great emotional distress, I can affirm the simple truth. This emotional distress is not owing to the circumstances. It's true, 999 out of 1,000 people might find a certain circumstance distressing. But as we said, even in that very circumstance, they're not static. There's greater acuteness of pain, and there's less acuteness of pain, and there are places in their life where they see that they move from point A to B in the presence of a certain challenge. That's the nature of the challenge. Seeing the fact that moods are daily, kind of ongoing circumstances, that points to the truth of the divine energy behind all life, including psychological experience, and the nature of our tests. Places in our life where something just feels consistently burdensome, there the test is also, it's a function of our circumstances plus our level of consciousness, plus our madriga. And if we're loyal to continuing to seek the divine in the presence of that ongoing distress, at a certain point, we're going to get out of Egypt. And that's how we acquire our relationship with the oneness of God. That's all that's what we're here for. So we are going to hereby conclude the recording. I want to remind folks that you're invited to, I appreciate the input and the feedback and the questions that I get either at 845-393-1529 or at henry@jewishwellbeing.org.